of the different poskim, right? And we focused really on two major sugyas. We focused on the sugya that has to do with the Ran and Gemara Ksuvos, Amsa Debei Rebbe, the death of Rebbe, and how we saw that in that context, clearly she was misfollowed and he should basically not make it through and end his suffering. And the Ran saw that as an appropriate thing to do, and it seems to be the accepted view. And then we saw that there was a bit of a steer later on, because there's a concept of you're allowed to be Mechal Shabbos even for moments of life. And yet, the Ramah talks about somebody who's a Goses, at least, being able to be Mesir Hamoneya, to do things passively to allow this person to die sooner than they would. Those are the major parts. What was in the middle were the Mekoros, that we didn't get into that much, but you should just know about them again, is clear statements of Chazal where they recognize that pain could be worse than death. It isn't like we're living, like we're accused of, often, living in this Pollyannic, rose-colored glasses environment where we think that life is always better than pain.
But how are we able to choose when is the pain strong enough that we can say...
So that's where we get to now, practical. So now we have these six sheikhs that are going to work with these makoros and develop approaches. And what we're going to have to do is decide, what do we do with this? We're going to have six approaches from one extreme to the other. I'm going to tell you what most Rabbanim do, and then I'll give you some advice for you personally on how to deal with this. Okay? So if you look at page, I don't know what number the page is. Does anyone know? Which book? Page that has...
Renewing the journal, right?
No, we'll get to Renewing the Journal in a minute.
I have one question.
First, we're going to finish up this handout. So it's on page that has the Tzitz Eliezer on top, and then David Rabbi Gleichen on the bottom.
I'm not sure.
Why don't
it's
we have it number
it's
one
two.
Here?
Yeah, it's two on the left. It's two in the top.
Oh, okay. So, right.
I'm not sure.
Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to go from the most machmir shita, most machmir means, the one who is the least yielded on letting a person die, which is the Tzitz Eliezer with Voldemort. Voldemort basically does the following. He looks at the Ran and the Gemara Ksuvos, and he says, I'm not even going to learn from here that you could be misfollowed when someone should die. Because he's going to say, we don't paskin like Amstel Rebbe. We paskin like Chachamim against Amstel Rebbe. Since when does she hold weight? The Chachamim were davening that he should live. So she throws this jar and tricks everybody to stop davening. Why are we paskin like her? Granted, she's a Talmid Chachamah, but does she stay there? Right? It's Rabbim against the Yochid.
Yeah,
and the Ran, he says, the Ran, which he has to answer up for, is a Das Yochid. He says, well, the other Rishonim don't quote it. So it's not true that it's other Rishonim do quote it, but he's saying the majority of Rishonim don't. Where is it in the Rambam? Where is it in the Rif? Where is it in the Rush? Our big three. So he wants to say we don't really hold like that, even though he's going to be the outlier on this. He's the only one who says this. He is the only one who says this. So obviously in the other areas he's going to even be more machmir. He's going to say, what did the Rambam mean by allowing us to take away the salt, or allowing us to stop the wood chopper and let this guy die?
Even if he's already dead.
He has this incredible idea. It has to be a situation where the person, the chole, is mamish, dead already. And he's dead for all intents and purposes, but there's some artificial something that's keeping his neshama from breaking away. It's almost as though he's looking at the process. If I could be as bold as to understand the Tzitz Eliezer, it's the only way I could do it, is that he's viewing it as though Misa has occurred. The neshama's separated from the body, but stuck in there somehow.
How does that make sense?
And that's Mesir Moneah. Moneah that neshama from flying away. So the modern equivalent is this idea that the only one who comes off a ventilator, the Tzitz Eliezer, is somebody who's already got cardiac death, which is an incredible thing. So that is the most severe and extreme sheep. You want to say something?
No, I'm just going to say the modern.
Right. That's like the modern one. So Rabbi Gleich does not go that far. Right? Number one, he recognizes that we do hold like the Ran, that in terms of tefillah, even Rabbi Gleich, and I'm saying even Rabbi Gleich because he's going to be very machmir in terms of the rest of the list, even he will acknowledge that a person should not feel guilty, right? And unfortunately, most of us go through this in our lives. When we have a loved one who's very, very sick and suffering, and we're visiting them, and we know what it means, that you're misfollowed, that the suffering should not be prolonged. You're never going to be misfollowed, someone should die. That's a horrible thing to do. You can't do that.
No, but according to him...
But you can say, you make a tefillah, that the suffering, should end.
Can you, according to Tessellier, can you do that?
No.
Can you only, you have to document that he stays alive no matter what? Or
is there, right, he gives a whole lecture on how a person should appreciate every moment of life and its kedusha, and that despite the pain, we're meant to suffer. It's a whole shkafa. You have to read the piece inside to really get the flavor, but that was my take-home message. He was very extreme in that regard.
Do most people, I mean, it sounds weird that he's the,
no, he's the only one.
That he's the only one who seems to think that
I'm sure there's other people that think that.
No, but I'm saying
the major person, he's the one.
In terms of the Gemara, where she...
He's the only one I heard make
that says that she's wrong. That maybe she's wrong. Everyone else seems to think that... But
well, I gotta tell you
okay.
The truth. I want to tell you the truth. It always bothered me.
Why is no one saying, like, it's okay,
it seems
everyone
very,
assumes
it seems
that
like a
she's
reasonable, it seems like a very reasonable argument, right? Why on earth do we follow Amsterdam? Bottom line is we do.
That's the way the Gemara seems to lead.
Yes.
It's not like Gemara says, oh, she
exactly.
was wrong. I don't criticize
her. The truth of the Gemara is that they accept her. That's what all the other Rishonim and Acharonim sees about. Exactly. That, look, the Gemara themselves sort her way. They're recording this for that purpose. So that's the argument against it. Okay. Comes along Rabbi Black and he says, so we're going to accept prayer. Right? Prayer is okay. Let me lead you through the different sections. But then, what does he do with the Ramah? He has the Ramah, right? Anyone who's Machmir has to deal with the Mekil, right? So the Ramah sounds like he's being Mekil in allowing us to take somebody off, or at least to be Mesa the Moneah. So Rabbi Bleich will tell you that this applies his emphasis to a Goses and to a Goses alone, which, by the way, is almost impossible to define. So he's almost removing the possibility, because he says... The Ramah is talking about a very, very specific, limited situation. And if you're able to define a goses, which we're going to see in a moment, if we get to that other handout, we won't be, then follow the Ramah. But short of that, if you don't have a goses, and you're not sure you have a goses, you must do everything. This is Rabbi Bleich's practical approach. I've been in cases with him. And I'm telling you that he is a very much a do-everything approach. Now, does he acknowledge what if the person is just purely suffering? We realize it's a terminal case, but Moshe Feinstein is going to be matir, right? Not intervening on, right? What about what do you say to that? I mean, there's rayas that you don't have to prolong somebody's suffering, so he'll acknowledge that. But what he says is there's no such thing. In other words, in theory, if there was such a case that a person was in intractable pain, and the only option he had, and he's like at terminal illness, he would say, in theory, we would not have to prolong that life. But he says, this is his big chap, lefiyan yistaito, meaning that other people don't necessarily accept. And I'll say why I have a problem with it personally, right? That is what he says, that all pain can be controlled.
So that what?
All pain can be controlled. There's no such scenario. In other words, modern medicine, and he cites article after article, all anesthesia journals, showing that we're coming such a long way and we can take care of pain now so that everybody virtually can be kept alive and out of pain. Problem is, and lo aleinu, none of you should ever know it, but anyone who's experienced any of these horrible situations will find out that there's pain. That's a physical agony from, you know, some type of sharp, dull, pressurized sensation. That's pain. And then there's suffering that comes from less tangible pain. There's a suffering, for example, of a terminally ill person with cancer who is bloated and unable to go to the bathroom himself. And has to go to the bathroom all the time. And will need to have all sorts of special things that I don't even want to get too graphic with you. But you can imagine that there's pain and suffering beyond something that can be treated with morphine. And morphine can treat pain. You know, that's something that hurts. But it can't necessarily undo suffering that's also involved in terminal illness. And that, I think, Rabbi Bleich is not accounting for in his statement that all pain can be treated, because I have been through cases where we try as much as we can, and we can't do it. So, I mean, we can't eliminate the suffering. We can eliminate a certain degree of pain, and you can put the person out, and maybe that's what Rabbi Bleich would suggest, just put the person out cold, right? Then you run into the danger of killing them, which, by the way, is going to be another shiloh. Why am I allowed to use morphine if I know it'll hasten to them? So, you should know, this is a famous secular ethics question. Right? Rishon Zalman, for one, was making on this issue, meaning you can't use a lethal dose of morphine, right? No. That might be okay in certain secular ethical circles. You can even use a lethal dose. You know that this thing is likely going to kill the person. What you're allowed to do is, you know, in theory, morphine will depress respirations, will lower blood pressure. Those things could conceivably lead to a hastening of death. So maybe I shouldn't try to relieve the pain? No. You can put that out of your mind. You can think of it as a davashen miskaven, right? But not a psik resha. Everyone understand those terms, right? Mm-hmm. In Hilchos Shabbos, we have a davashen miskaven, which is mutter. But if it's a psik resha, it's aser. What does that mean? It means that you can do a malacha. You can do something if it may result in malacha, may not. However, psik resha means that you do this, it's definitely going to result in malacha. So the psik resha is aser. But the davashen miskaven is mutter. So I'm just using this analogy. So analogously here, when Shlomo Zalman comes out to say, and what the post came out to say, and I think this is the prevalent view, and I'm telling you this right up front because you're going to encounter it, is you can use morphine, despite its known potential side effects, for the purpose of relieving pain, not to kill somebody. You can never use morphine to kill somebody. But you can use it to relieve pain, and not have to say and account for every possibility that it might end up killing somebody. Okay? So anyway, but Blech thus becomes a very machmer shita as well.
Does that apply in situations when you know that even a small dose of morphine would kill someone?
No, if it's a bad day, then you're
going to have a lethal dose.
Then you're
going to have. Then it's like equal
to a secret.
So it's totally dependent on the case.
Yes, yes. And at least that's my understanding of it. I'm saying it that way because I think there are people that would disagree with me, but I think they're wrong.
Isn't there
I think the pasha is wrong.
Isn't there a Supreme Court thing where they do allow the other way also, where it's kind of like, Rattana talks about it in the Bible.
Secular.
Yeah, he says it makes him very angry that they just have like.
That's a famous. I'm saying it's a famous issue.
It's like Catholic
it's called
double
the, yeah,
something.
The double. I'm blanking on the word. That's what I was trying to say. The double jeopardy.
Rabbi, aren't there cases when, like with the psik resha, that that it does become mutar, especially if you have a psik resha plus another lenient, I don't know what the term would be, something else that's lenient, like a Shabbos, you know, like in terms of like alarm systems. Yeah, Jalal Nichola, exactly. So then if you have the two together, it creates
There's no one, the analogy does not carry on.
Okay, but I'm just saying, I don't know, maybe it works.
Okay.
I was trying to.
See, in Shabbos it works because the Lov Nichole in Shabbos makes it into a Malach.
Exactly, because then you like have the two together, they work together. Okay.
All right. Turn the page, we're going to be getting more and more Makil, right? So we saw the two extreme
double
sheets.
Effect.
What?
Double effect?
Right, double effect. That's it. The double effect is this issue of treating pain knowing full well that it's going to kill the person. But it goes much further than what I'm saying. Because the double effect, if you're making on the double effect of secular ethics, you're saying you know this is very likely to kill a person, but you're allowed to be conscious of only one thing. The real reason, you're not doing it for that purpose, right? It's like, this is like a
the patient wants to relieve their pain.
Right. You're doing it to relieve the person of pain. It might be true that you're very consciously aware of the fact that you're killing them, but that's not why you're doing it. So double effect allows you to do it. I'm saying we don't go that far.
Right. What's the difference between that and Dabar Shem?
Because it's the definitiveness of it. They'll say double effect even in a psik resha case. They'll say, look, I'm not trying to kill him. Intent counts. We're saying, no. Dabar Shem Iskavet is intent is part of it, but it's also the fact that it might not happen. They don't need that. Alright. Comes along what I think is the mainstream shita. Meaning, from my experience of dealing with these cases, and what different rabbanim are following, is Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Moshe Feinstein. They're kind of like the most popular shita. And you could throw in Rav Wozner and Rav Yoshev are very similar as well. These are all the major poskim. And they have the following approach. First of all, they learn the Ran and the Ksuva Sugya Kipshuto for sure, right? That's how we pass it. And they understand the Ramah, right? The one who's most explicit about this is Rav Moshe Feinstein, understands that Ramah. That basically, the Ramah is dealing with the Gosis, because that's, like Rabbi Blatt said, he's dealing with the Gosis. However, I think Rav Moshe sees the Gosis as representative of a type of patient. What type of patient? What is it about Kasisa? It is an extremely painful experience.
Which it doesn't have to be there.
Even in an unconscious patient.
Wow.
That's what Moshe says. That what we're learning is that the metaphysical event of being a gosis and departure of the soul is exceedingly painful. And that was the matir that the Ramah used. The Ramah was able to say, you're allowed to be Meser Moneh and shorten this person's life. Why? Not like Rabbi Blair says, only because he's defined strictly as a gosis. But Rav Moshe says, because he's like a gosis, which is in severe, severe pain. So therefore, Rav Moshe now opens it up.
Be a gosis.
It does not have to be mamash gosis, number one. It's any patient, terminal. Here, he has to be terminal. The terminal doesn't mean gosis. Gosis means 3 days left. That is a very specific definition. We'll see in a minute. We're talking about a terminal patient who has no hope for cure. He can live another year. He can live another 2 years. But he has no hope for cure. Actually, let's keep it to Chayesha. Okay, Chayesha Olam gets a little tricky. He's going to live less than a year, but he can live for months. Right?
He opens up the
he can live for months.
To deal with a lot of
but he's in horrible pain. He's getting chemotherapy that's like beyond imagination. So what do? We do everything we code this person and we'll do CPR and we'll keep them going in order to prolong this life of agony. But Moshe says no, you don't have to do that. So the first level is in regards to instituting different therapies. In a case like that, a DNR is a very appropriate thing. Meaning no intubation, no chest compressions, no therapeutic measures. He draws the line, as does Rosh Hashanah Zalman, on what they consider davar tziviyim, natural needs. What are the natural needs?
Food and drink.
Food and water and oxygen. Right? Food, water, and oxygen. They say that you can never withhold and you can never take away. Even in the most pain-ridden patient. Now, it just so happens, they're saying it because they'll say it's not part of the heter. You can't take away davar tziviyim. To me, the suffering of dehydration, starvation, and suffocation is incredible. And for me, those will never be an advantage to somebody to take those away. That's a horrible way to go.
Food and water.
And you're going to see other posts don't agree with this. And in real life, for sure they don't agree with this. Chatzan is oxygen. So water, food, nutrition, and oxygen, according to Rishon Bazam, the mainstream Shita, Moshe Feinstein, must be given. What they both agree on is the heroic measures, what they consider heroic measures, which is all the classic DNR stuff. They're willing to withhold that from the person who's going to just have a terminal life of pain. Question.
So are you allowed to let them code if they're is that meaning yeah.
Yeah,
that's the question. Yeah. You're allowed to.
In other words, if there's a patient, yeah.
Meaning in the middle of surgery.
This is the doctor and the rabbi together.
Right.
And they've decided that this patient is terminally ill. There is no hope for a cure. Their life is one endless agony. All you should be doing for them is whatever you can to minimize their pain. That should be your entire focus. Minimize their pain, which means give them food, in my opinion, fluid, nutrition, and oxygen. And it means a lot of morphine as needed. And it means dignity, and it means keeping them clean and not getting all the complications. It might mean, under certain conditions, let's say there's an incidental illness that comes in the middle. Right? Here's where it gets tricky. So someone gets pneumonia. They're like this. So one shita will say, well, oh, good, now we got a killer thing there, let it kill them. But you might say, no, that's going to be a suffocation type death, treat it. It's not related to the underlying illness. That isn't just prolonging suffering. I might want to treat that. But here's where it's a little murky, because, well, it is prolonging suffering. Let the guy go, this will kill him sooner. So that might, this is where there's differences amongst the different poskim. Some will view it, and you as the doctor are going to be called upon to make these calls. You have to understand. You're going to, I've been through this 100 times.
Meaning like?
You're going to have to determine the significance of everything that's going on. I told you at the beginning of this whole topic that I was amazed that this Rosh Hashiva was like getting me involved and had me take over the whole case. But it was, I mean, he had some confidence that I knew the halacha, but he also realized that there's such intricacies to a lot of the issues from a medical perspective that he's not equipped. So at the end, I brought him back in because they came to a point like a psak like this. I said, look, I'm going to describe for you the medical reality for sure. I have my opinion on what I should do, but you're the posek for the patient. You need to put the paskin, not me. I'm not paskin for this patient. You come to me as a posek. You give to me your medical advice, your medical understanding. It would have been different if they came to me as a posek. So, okay, if I felt qualified, right, and then I would, but I certainly didn't. And he was the posek. So I brought him back in, and together, it's often that's how it is. You're together with the rabbi, and he, a good, well-informed rav, knows the nuances and is going to be asking these questions. Most of Rabbanim, again, are going like this Rav Shlomo Zalman and like Rav Moshe Feinstein, and they're going to be looking to make this dichotomy, to make the split between Dabar Tadiyim and that kind of thing, or things that are extraneous to the underlying illness that are going to cause more suffering that maybe I will cure. Right? Those are going to be things you will treat, and you're going to be focused on palliation and relieving pain. But you're not going to be doing anything. A dinar is going to be okay by these poskim. Right? This is why the family's got to really, and I'm going to be emphasizing it in a minute, the family's got to be up on things. You've got to be communicating with the family. Let them know these decisions need to be made, because we're going to see what happens, the horrible thing that happens when there's no decision made up front. And when we're afraid to talk about these things, that's what that argument is going to be about.
Could you repeat about what you mean by extraneous to the...
Right. Sometimes you're in a situation like this. You have a terminal illness that, let's say, a person has a type of cancer where the treatment of that cancer will just be a living nightmare. Right? It's just filled with nausea, vomiting, and loss of everything, and horror. Mm-hmm. So what's the outcome? So the doctor will tell you, well, we got a 98% chance the patient will die anyway. 2% chance that you'll get a month out of it. So you say to yourself, I'm not an idiot. I'm not doing that to my loved one. Right? And the patient will choose themselves. I'm not taking that. Right? If they're of sound mind and body, they should make the choice. Because maybe somebody wants it. I want another month. I want to go to the wedding. I want to do this. Those elements come into it. The patient's got to be involved in the decision. However, so you can opt out of that kind of treatment. Because all that will do is prolong suffering of an individual. What about... that same patient now gets an incidental pneumonia, and a lot of them are a little immunocompromised, so they get a pneumonia. The decision to treat that is a completely different decision. On the one hand, why should I not treat it? Well, I have a terminal patient, he's going to die anyway, this will make him die sooner. Okay. But it's the treatment for it is innocuous, it's benign, it's going to just make it better. So many postcards say you must do that, right? Including emotion. Antibiotics for the pneumonia, you got to do it. The chemotherapy that's going to make them a living nightmare, that you don't have to. So that's where you're going to have to be pointing out that this is a treatment that relates to an incidental illness that's not part of the underlying, impossibly treated, horribly suffering outcome. And, you know, there's other examples like this. I'll be on the test, you'll see.
And if it's not any kind of serious situation where it's just basic DNR, not DNR, most of us can still agree to that. Where do we draw the line?
Turns off. I mean, let me just finish up the whole question, then we'll do all specific cases.
No, this is very general. I'm saying just general.
No,
you're saying the guy's dying less than a year.
He's dying.
And all of us can agree, no fancy schmancy, but the food, drinking, well, you know, food, drinking, oxygen.
If he's suffering.
If he's suffering.
By the way, if he's not suffering, here's where it gets really tricky. Let's say it's the worst state to be in. Persistent vegetative state. Now, on this, we're going to, up till now, there's not a single posek that will treat, meaning of Waldenberg, or by Bleich, or Moshe, or Shlomo Zalman. We'll see the next crew are going to be different on this particular area. Maybe not all of them. But the quality of life means nothing. What we're dealing with is suffering and pain. We, as far as we know, most doctors will say a persistent vegetative state is not painful. There's no pain. What do I lose? My whole hetter, my whole macule sheath. Meaning, and this is where the most bikuach between the secular people and the rabbinic people happens. A persistent vegetatively stated person, or someone analogous to it, you know, where their mind is not there. They're demented, right? Something like that. A typical demented, frail person. Alzheimer's or something like that. Where the secular world looks at them as that this is a pointless life. Are they in pain? No. And it gets a little tricky. Some Alzheimer's are. Right? But let's say we have someone who's just not in pain. So the Rabbanim that are following the Shittas up till now will say you must do everything, including no DNR for that person. You can't put quality of life, devoid of pain, as a reason to allow even passively. So that's a big area of contention, because those are the most difficult. That's where you get into the fights. They think you're crazy. They don't understand it. They just think you're wasting resources. You know, what's motivating them? I would love to think that they're just thinking of the dignity and the autonomy of the person.
Money.
But I think most people talk about it really is an economic decision.
And just what's the difference? Is there a difference between Shlomo Arak
and Moshe?
Moshe. With regard to this?
I think as a bottom line, there's not. I think as a bottom line, there's not. There are slight difference of expression, the reasoning, the way they derive it is a little different. Right? I think the bottom line is pretty much the same.
As long as the first, it doesn't apply only to a Buddhist state. It doesn't have to be a Buddhist
state.
Person has to be someone who's suffering.
Right.
And as long
they'll be using the term gosis loosely. They'll say gosis means any term of either a person.
Not just 3 days.
Right.
As long as you can drink food.
Correct. I can't think of anything else where I would separate. Even the part about the Davar Tiviyim, they both mention it. They mention it differently. But it's interesting that they weren't talking to each other. Independently, they came up with the same sheet. That's interesting. It doesn't always happen.
So for an example, like the one where it's like 98% is going to die, 2% is going to, or even like we'll even go to 99% is going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And he does this DNR and like everything, there's nothing going to be done to save his life. Is that, it's slightly off topic, but is that person allowed to then be slightly negligent and because he's immunosuppressed or whatever, still go out and try to live as normal of a life as possible during those times because he knows he's going to die anyway, so who cares if he's
right? It is slightly off topic, but I like the question actually. You know, you're talking about a scenario where
he's immunosuppressed.
He's making this decision, obviously.
Right.
Good. And it's going to be a good segue into Rav Shechter's shita, which we're about to do. But I'm not doing Rav Shechter yet, because I don't think he would necessarily agree with what I'm about to say. I'm thinking more now of what we've done up till now. I would say that that everyone would recognize that the person who's making this autonomous decision, you know, to forego the month of suffering, right, and not be treated, will then obviously not be allowed to commit suicide, right? But I would think to live life to the fullest that he chooses to do, within reason. So in other words, you know, no one's going to be that immunosuppressed who didn't get the chemo. If they got the chemo, then they might be very immunosuppressed.
You know, I'm saying.
But if they didn't get the chemo and they just have cancer,
right.
No one's going to put any holds on what they're going to be doing with their life.
Right.
They can't do stupid things. They can't inject themselves with
arsenic. But I'm saying with the chemo.
Yeah, I don't think that anyone's going to start putting like restrictions on their life to that degree. If that's what you're asking, in other words, like that they have to watch out, be extra careful about getting a cold or this or that.
Well, because like either
be reasonable, but I got a few weeks left.
Like one of the big no-nos is movie theaters. Like you cannot go to the movie theaters when you're immunosuppressed and on chemotherapy.
Yeah.
Saying if the guy wanted to go to the movies,
I certainly wouldn't stop him.
So that's what I'm saying. Like even though it's negligent, even
no one has a true bond. Just question. But I hear what you say, and I'm telling you that I don't think I would. I can't imagine anyone's going to ask him unless they say you know passionish movie.
No,
but other than that, I got it. And I think the fiend is started. So I can tell you on this because there's nothing written on this type of question. I would let them, you know, not do anything stupid, but like enjoy. Make the most of your last time. I would hope that they would do something. If it was me, I'd be looking to get as many points as I could. You know? But everyone has to choose what they want to do. Yep. I mean, as a rabbi, I might be advising them some good ideas. But it's totally their choice.
I'm saying, like, they're going into Big Sunday.
As a doctor,
as a doctor,
do whatever you want to do. You know, like, that would be my attitude. As a doctor.
As a rabbi.
As a rabbi.
It's also.
And as a, yeah, in other words, it's not us.
Right.
Do we apply this to everyone, just to clarify, like Jews, non-Jews?
No. The non-Jews can do whatever they want. In other words, we're talking
about... I'm treating a non-Jew. I'm saying, does it change at all?
Well, yeah, very much.
It does. So when we're talking about this case with...
Remember the list I had on the top line that everybody agrees to?
Yeah.
You know, about acting the killer, about passing the killer, about the killer. So all that applies to non-Jews. For sure. If I'm going to kill a non-Jew, I can't pass him to kill a non-Jew. If the Hebrews are killing a non-Jew, I can't do all those things.
Okay, but I'm saying in this case, let's say
the rest of it, it's up to them. Meaning, like, I'm going to respect. Oh, here's where it becomes a shame. I'll tell you, he's one of the test questions. Right? I mean, it didn't involve an algebra, he didn't make it involve an algebra. You know what, I'll make it involve one Jew, one non-Jew.
Okay.
To illustrate this. If I have a non-Jew who's, let's say if I have a Jew, and I'm being asked, I'm in an ICU, this is a typical scenario that happens. You're in an ICU, and you're in charge of the patients, you're gonna make the ultimate decisions, you're gonna be turning off machines, you're the resident, you're the unfortunate resident who's gonna make things happen. So, there is a person, let's make it easy. There is no DNR on the chart.
It's a non-Jew.
Jew. Start with a Jew. Okay. And I'm going to tell you probably no difference between Jew and non-Jew. There's a no DNR on the chart, and the doctors have decided, you know, this hopeless. He's been on the vent now for 8 weeks. He's trached already, which is what happens after 1 month. They put a trach in instead of a tube. It's much more damaging than a tube, than whatever. There's no decision in terms of that. We're not getting anywhere with this guy. Time to get him off. Right? So to me, you're killing him when you do that.
This is already on.
So whether it's a Jew or a non-Jew, I can't.
Okay, but what about in the case that we were just discussing, let's say,
deciding on chemotherapy?
Cancer.
So I hold that even a Jew can make that decision. So certainly a non-Jew can make that decision. Yeah, and the only places there'll be differences is when I'm
not a Jew. Of course, when they make the decision, you know, you have to pursue.
Legally, right.
Yeah, legally.
I'll be dead also, unless it involves murdering them. Right?
Yeah.
That's what you have to realize. None of this is murder. I mean, there'd be no room to be mako in an act of murder, whether it's indirect or direct. It's not instituting therapy, right? So, now.
You like
that? Almost case of pneumonia.
Whatever it's murder for a Jew, it'd be murder for a non-Jew. So, for example, something that's like obviously the right thing to do, right? I have a 25-year-old healthy guy, and he's in a horrible accident. And the prognosis is if we save him, listen to this one, this is a really hard one. If we save him, he ends up a quadriplegic. If we let him go, he's not going to be a quadriplegic. Right, so do I save him or not? So the post came up till now, we'd probably all say yeah, I'm saying. Of Schechter, which is going to be our segue, we'd probably say you don't.
Well, how did the first post can explain?
Unless if you say, if you look at it that way, then
I mean, how else would you, like,
it's a little
how, does, how do they explain
the reason it isn't, because if you know for sure he's going to be in the life of agony, then yeah.
So in that case,
Rabbi Tzitzilias would say, save him, I don't care if he's in the life of agony. Rabbi Black would say, save him, he won't be in agony, we'll give him morphine. Shlomo Zalman and Rav Moshe might be willing to work with it. You know, it's hard to, you know, they there's room to say in their sheet that he's been in the life of agony, that's what the doctors are saying, they would say don't institute that.
If you're a resident, are you allowed to
I can't speak to them, obviously. Everything's case basically going to be really careful. Nuances all over the place, but in a general sense, they might say, okay, now, is there any difference in the guy and the Jew in that, these scenarios?
Are you allowed to turn off the machine if you're a resident working in a hospital? Well, luckily, you're a religious Jew. What do you do?
You can't commit murder.
So what do you do?
So you say no.
You tell the doctor no?
You can consciously no. No one's going to make you do that. You might get it. Here's where you're going to have
you get like
here's one of the misiones. My advice is always try to avoid it as much as possible, but you have a right not
like
to
pretend to faint or something.
Right. You say you can if you have a normal person, he realizes that there's different opinions and attitudes, religious principles, etc. You don't have to. You think you're the only one that can turn this to the vent. You get a million people to turn to the vent. It's lahachas that he's making you turn to the vent if he knows it's against your conscience. So I mean, I had this happen once. Yeah. I actually had to have it out with the guy. You know, and I said no, I can't. It was a scenario. I was a kid. So I thought for sure the guy's going to be understanding. And he made a big mistake, but the chairman was with me. So that worked out well.
Can you tell someone else to do it? Or is it the same thing?
Just as good. It's Cheryl has to take himself out of the case. When it's moving into the situation where their decision is made, now, my field now, this happens all the time, is a certain diagnosis called hypoplastic left heart syndrome. It's a bad disease. I once drew you a picture, maybe. One right ventricle, no left ventricle.
Yeah.
And the whole attitude change has occurred. There's a palliation that's 60-70% effect. Some people are still choosing, I don't want to go through it, I don't want to go through it. The family says, I don't want 3 operations, I don't want the whole deal. So to me, I have to save this kid. I think I know the end products are living full lives. They're not having lives of agony. I say do everything you possibly can to save that kid, including all the operations. And the family makes a decision not to. That's it. So that was the position I was put into. I was supposed to turn off. I said I can't, because I think we should be saving this. And the wise guy wasn't in my department. He's a new attendant who is basically has always loves to start up with me about religious things. This was the first head-to-head. And I said, I'm removing myself from the case. The management now is totally against my conscience. I will not be involved in this case. And you have to be. I said, no, I don't have to be. He said, I'm going to your chairman. I was only like a fellow or an early attendant. I'm something low on the totem, right? So he went to my chairman. Chairman called me in. I was, here it is, my big test of my life, what's going to happen. And I explained it to the chairman. And he said, absolutely, there's no reason you should have to do this. What does this have to do with you? You're in the business of saving lives. I said, yeah. Correct.
But he approved that you're pulling up for religious reasons.
Absolutely. I would think the majority, vast, overwhelming majority, would go that way. Not the firing. If they do, you have a court case. But I don't know any cases that have that. I have none of my friends, no one's in that.
Referring back to the case you described about the person who's quadriplegic, I mean, the poskim that say that, that it's the pain, you could do something about it. How can they really put, quantify pain? Like, where's that gauge? Like, it's such a subjective measure, especially if you're not through with it.
I would say 999 out of 1,000 people. I could be wrong. And tell me if I'm wrong. This is my guess. Would say that the life of a quadriplegic is a life of suffering and pain.
100% right.
That's it. Which brings us to Rav Shach, because we got to finish this so that we finish on Wednesday. Rav Shachter says like this. Rav Shachter has a very famous, unique approach to this whole area of halakha. And it's one that's built on solid makaros, right? Absolutely. And it's built on his personal understanding of halakha. He emphasizes the following principle. Above everything else, right? He recognizes all the statements about all the other Gedolim. But he says, the way it works is we don't have bilus over our own bodies, right? It is true. Everybody has to recognize that. The big separator of a Jew from a non-Jew in ethics is that there is not unlimited autonomy. They think there is, and we think there's not. Our bodies are unknown to us. Our lives are unknown to us from Shemayim. You can't just end it at will. Of course, Rav Shachter agrees with that. However, he says, there will be some degree of autonomy that definitely does exist. And where that autonomy exists, and he learns this from certain sugyas. He learns it from a sugya in Avodah Zarah Chafchas, where there's a talk about the four mitzorayim. We've talked about it in other contexts, where these four guys were outside the machana and they had to choose between definitely dying or taking a risk of chayei olam. Is familiar to you guys at all? Right? Where we have this whole story of... I don't have time to go into it in order to finish now. Maybe we can talk about it on Wednesday a little more. He's Makaros. But the bottom line is he cites examples of where we see clearly that the person gets to decide, to some degree, what happens to them. They can't kill themselves, so they don't have absolute autonomy, but they do have some autonomy. So where is the autonomy? Yes, and where's the autonomy? No. So Rav Shachter kind of lays it out like this. Where somebody makes a decision, and I'm going to use the numbers he uses, but they're not that specific. It's going to be a little... leeway in the numbers, but he says if somebody's making a decision meaning to live or to die, that one 999 out of 1,000 people would not do, we say batel die to itself kolata. So the example he always gives, I'll give you the example he gives. He says, let's say there's a guy, he's not a quadriplegic, but he needs an amputation or he's going to die, right? He needs an amputation of leg. It's the only thing he's going to do. He's going to have a plastic leg. So Rav Shechter will say 999, he believes, out of 1,000 people will say, cut my leg and let me live. The rest of him is okay. Once he cuts off the leg, he's totally fine. He has no other problems. He just has an artificial leg. So if somebody comes forward and says, I'd rather die than have my leg cut off, we say, batel die to tzokol adam, you don't have the right to do that. You can't choose death, rather, for that, because no one would agree with you. You don't have that type of autonomy. However, in a case like our quadriplegic, something like that, Rav Shechter believes that it's almost the opposite, meaning 999,000 people might say, I'd rather die. And if a guy says, I want to live, you might say, which is an incredible thing. In other words, if you don't, it's really, if the guy's mom is saying, I want to live, you listen to him. If you don't know, that's the kind of scenario where you have this possibility. If you don't know,
someone's saying,
he's in a coma.
Maybe, I'm not sure about
the guy's unconscious. There's no family around. We don't know what he would want. You're allowed to go with the 999 out of 1,000 people, what they would do, including if it's, don't do anything. Let me go.
Even though it's on the five principles, you can't kill?
You're not intervening. In other words, it's a person who you can do the full cardiac arrest, do the full code, you'll save them, and they'll end up in a state that 999 out of 1,000 people wouldn't want to be in.
What if it's more near 99 than half and half
or so? Oh, then he says like this, what if it's not these extremes? That's where you ask the patient. The patient can make a decision, and we're going to listen to him. And he says that this includes nutrition, hydration, and everything. He doesn't understand where that chiluk came up from. He criticizes that chiluk. He says, show me the core for such a chiluk. This is natural, that's not natural. He says, what does that mean? Where does Chazal tell us, all right, you can do the natural ones, you can't do the unnatural? He thinks it's contrived. And he thinks, across the board, the way it's going to work really is in these type of situations, which is why you'll see sometimes people have a terem to forego nutrition and hydration. It means that they're holding like Rav Shechter. It's really Mamish's psalm.
So that's where he holds his autonomy?
Most people don't hold this. Yeah, the autonomy is in between.
It's in the middle ground.
If you're not in the extremes, it's up to the patient. Now, if the patient didn't tell you and he's unconscious, it's more difficult. He's not so quick to say, oh, just let the family decide. If the family could tell you, you're deciding on the basis of what the patient would want, not what they would want, which is very tricky, because, again, anyone who's been through this knows, there's a lot of bias on the family. The family is almost the last person to ask, the last entity to ask, because whether they like it or not, admit it or not, the truth is, everybody is in a hurry because of personal considerations as well, meaning they're suffering. Don't learn them to be evil people. Right? I'm not talking because they're lazy or they're, you know, the money is... But they just can't stand it. They can't stand it. Yes, there are people like that. But
are the extreme cases or the middle ground?
The middle ground. Extreme cases, I don't care about the family.
Yeah.
It's battle everybody's dice against what normal people decide. Right? In the middle cases, which is a large number of cases, it's up to the patient, or if he left, which brings us to the quickly, let me just see this. What this article was about, and you should look through it, you know, we'll take this up Wednesday, because I don't want to take it for a long time. Wednesday, we're going to finish up this. If you can get a look, it'll actually be helpful. Let me see that number. Anyway, we're going to look at this on your own, and we'll discuss it. We'll see that I brought in, and maybe I'll copy this for you guys too if you want. This is a very interesting thing. This is the way to avoid the scenario where we don't know what's good. It is a living will. According to the RCA, the Rabbinic Council of America, this is Rabbi Tepler and friends, and according to the Aruba, and they're very different, and I'm going to discuss them with the Miley's and the Chasrami's. I'll tell you just a quick glimpse. This one, the RCA, has a million scenarios. All the different things that could happen to a person. In fact, I was thinking of taking your test out of this. Because it has like every medical possibility. This doesn't have anything like that. So what's the plus and minus of doing it? And what does this have instead?